The masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close trusted view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zaius.
Very well.
Where would we be without THC? Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
All right, Higher Side Chatters, we've seen the pattern of powerful people belonging to various groups that utilize the magical arts, and we've done several shows on various magical practices in an attempt to even the scales and add these esoteric arts to the repertoire of the common man. But contrary to popular beliefs, you don't need to spend years studying Tantra in the Himalayas or working through the ranks of the OTO in a dingy basement to learn what they don't want you to know. In fact, today's guest, Mike Sententia, has been working on one of the most straightforward and practical brands of magic I've come across, appropriately dubbed Direct Magic, which he lays out on his popular website, magicofthought.com. So throw off the silly robes and stop brushing up on Latin, because we're diving right into the belly of this beast. It's always a fun ride, looking at the hidden potential of our own mind, and I'm psyched to get down to it. Magic Mike, my man, welcome to the Higher Side.
Hey, Greg, I'm really excited to be here. And yeah, that's exactly what I'm about, is let's step outside of all of the robes and the rituals and all of the trappings that traditionally go with magic. And let's just explore what's the underlying phenomenon. What are the moving pieces? And how can we work with them directly to produce the results that we're looking for?
Heck yeah, I love it. That's basically how I found you. I was looking for a good guest that could talk about the science or the mechanisms behind magic, and that really does seem to be at the heart of your approach, you know, because sometimes this stuff can be very vague and hard to pin down, and that's a problem for people. But to kick this off, tell us a bit about direct magic and what separates it from other modalities out there.
So most modalities, what you're doing is you're doing a ritual or a visualization, or some other symbolic action. And the point of that symbolic action is to engage your unconscious mind, communicate your intent to your unconscious, and then your unconscious is going to go out and do something. And I know you've talked with folks who do chaos magic. That's another example. They're using belief to communicate their intent to their unconscious mind, which then goes out and does something.
Mm-hmm.
And the focus of direct magic is saying, great, we got all these methods. It's really important to have at least one way of communicating to your unconscious. But after you get your intent into your unconscious mind, what does it do? What's that something? How does it reach out and cause this change? And by understanding that process, how can we refine it? How can we guide the unconscious mind through a better process that has more effective, more reliable results? And so in direct magic, we talk about what I call ethereal muscles. These are the parts of the mind that are normally unconscious, that drive energy and drive magic. And one of the first things that we do when we learn direct magic is to make those ethereal muscles conscious. It's a similar idea as using biofeedback to make your heartbeat conscious.
Right.
And by becoming consciously aware of these normally unconscious parts, we can then engage them anytime we want, whether we're, you know, in a place where we can be fully focused and do a ritual, or whether we're on the train or in the waiting room getting ready for a job interview. We don't need to do all of the trappings because we know how to engage these parts of the mind at will. And we can also watch them as they go through all the steps and say, great, how is this part of my mind connecting with this force that I'm channeling? Or what part of the human energy field, the biofield, am I interacting with when I do this healing technique? And what if I change it in this way? How does that affect things? By developing an understanding of the moving parts, the forces, the different structures of the biofield, we can think about new ways of interacting with them and develop new techniques. Let me give you an example.
Sure.
Because I like to make things concrete. So a few years ago, a friend came to me. She had chronic hives. She'd had hives for 9 months. She was on prescription antihistamines. She was getting the best Western medical care. She was a nurse, so she was really getting the best care available. but she was still getting worse. And neither of us really knew if I could do anything there. I'd been doing a lot of healing around knee pain and things like that, but hives is really complicated. So I did a technique. I first just started with kind of focusing on my intent to heal her. I connected to the skin that was inflamed, which was really her whole body. I connected to the skin. I set some healing energy, and her itching went from an 8 out of 10 down to a 7 out of 10, which I really consider a failure. Like, I want a more pronounced result.
I respect that.
So I went back and I said, all right, great. When I just focus on my intent, what happens is my ethereal muscles connect to her skin and we do this. Well, the itching signals are sent by all these nerves that go from her skin up her spine into her brain. What if I make a conscious step of connecting to those nerves? And you can think of that conscious step as visualizing. There's actually some concrete techniques involved that we might get into later. But take this conscious step of connecting to her nerves. Guide my mind through doing that. And then feel the energy signature of those nerves and act on that. Mm. And when we did that, her itching dropped from an 8 out of 10 to a 4 out of 10. And I consider that a pretty big success.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing that, it's about guiding the mind through a new process that's maybe not natural and automatic, but that winds up being more effective. It's a similar idea to how Olympic athletes will watch videos and consciously think about how they run and how they move. And if you've ever tried to do this, you know that you're clumsy at first, that thinking about how you run makes you run much worse. But the athletes who are dedicated to this, who put in the time to learn to do it, eventually it becomes a smooth thing. Eventually they can train their body to move in a new, more efficient way that then through practice becomes natural and unconscious. And that's really what we're doing with direct magic, is becoming conscious of how the mind responds to our intent to heal or create luck or whatever we're doing. Become conscious of that. Guide it through a new process, even if that's going to be clumsy at first. And then through practice and experience, make that new, more effective process natural and automatic, and really rewire how our mind responds to intent. So that's what direct magic is about.
Mm, well said, man. I like the approach. I feel like if there are underlying mechanisms that make this stuff possible, it must be doable without the rituals, without the candles and without the robes. I mean, to some degree, I know that's about getting into a mindset, but mm-hmm. I guess if you can get yourself into a mindset without the theatrics, I mean, that's just as good. That's basically a, not to, you know, overuse the term, but that's a more direct path to magic.
That's where the name comes from, in fact.
Right on. So how did you come to develop this over the years? I mean, how did magic go from what probably started as an abstract interest, which I think is where a lot of the listeners might be, to an actual, reliable, useful set of skills that you can call on? Talk to us a little bit about your path in developing magic.
So first, I want to say that this is absolutely an indirect path, and I'm not going to recommend that your listeners follow it, but I would love to share that.
Sure.
So when I was 11, this was in 1991, one of my friends, who honestly read a lot of fantasy novels and wished he lived in one, started talking about magic and energy and things like that. And we were at an age where the line between things you actually believe and things you play with and things you pretend to believe, at 11, those are all kind of the same thing. And so we started playing around with this. What we didn't realize, though, was that his books would draw from actual occultism, like the Golden Dawn and chaos magic, would draw from energy healing like Reiki and therapeutic touch. And this was the 90s, so there was already peer-reviewed research in energy healing going around. We had no idea at 11, but now I can tell you this was already being, you know, researched by the National Institute of Health. Mm-hmm. So it was drawing from real stuff. And so some of the things that we were trying out and we were playing with were drawn from real legitimate ways of approaching this. And some of it was just fantasy novel stuff. And over probably a decade, you know, throughout my teens, I would have these experiences and some of them would work really well. I would connect to trees and feel the energy. And at the time, I would think of it as talking to the trees. Nowadays, I think of it as absorbing the energy and letting that influence your mind in a lot of a similar way to how a drug might influence one's mind.
Hmm.
And then experiencing my own mind high on that energy from the tree, in the same way that taking a trip on a drug is experiencing your own mind influenced by that drug. And I would connect with spirits, and some of them were probably real spirits, and some of them were probably aspects of my own mind. And I would build energy in my body and see how that influenced physical stamina and healing and just created sensations. And through all of these experiences, I really wanted to know what was happening. What was going on under the hood? My family were scientists and atheists, and so I wasn't able to share any of this with them, but I was raised with this real love of science. And when I say that, a lot of people hear love of technology or love of standard scientific results, and there is some of that, but really, science is about understanding the moving parts of a phenomenon. When a scientist encounters, you know, a rainbow. This is a classic example from Newton and Yeats. When a scientist encounters a rainbow, he says, what caused that? And he doesn't just want to know the answer is refraction, right? I can tell you refraction. And if you don't already know what that means, I haven't actually told you anything. I've given you a password.
Yeah.
What the scientist wants to say is, well, water droplets are really, they're little spheres and they behave like a prism. And when sunlight hits the sphere and it reflects, the different wavelengths reflect off the curved surface at slightly different angles. And if you're standing at the right spot to see that sunlight reflected off of the water droplet, that creates a rainbow. And to me, that is just as beautiful as the actual set of colors in front of my eyes. And that's what I brought to all of these phenomena and all of these experiences that were happening to me that I didn't understand and that really nobody, still nobody fully understands. And I said, well, all of these different ways of approaching this, whether it's a ritual or a visualization or channeling or lighting a candle or whatever, they're all, one, the results they get out are much more complicated than whatever the person's putting in, right? I could do a ritual and speak 100 words of Latin, but those 100 words are not enough to program a computer in how to understand the type of situation I'm looking to create, and certainly not enough to explain to a computer how to bring about the type of situation I'm looking to create. There's additional complexity in magic that isn't coming from the ritual and isn't coming from the visual and isn't coming from my mind, because I'm not aware of how this thing is going to manifest. I'm not constantly thinking about it. I'm thinking about it for 5 minutes now, and then it's off and running. Well, what's off and running? Where is this thing running? And if all of these different systems that have different explanations and different theories are all producing similar results, well, they're probably all acting by the same mechanism. Whenever out in the world we see a bunch of things that have different explanations, and those explanations are accurate, they produce different results. When we see a bunch of phenomena that all do the same thing, they usually have the same mechanism. So what is that mechanism? And I started thinking about what I now call ethereal software.
Right.
These forces that respond to a person's intent, that provide healing energy or create luck or do whatever else the person's trying to do with magic or healing. And that was kind of the first breakthrough of really getting one piece of the puzzle. And this happened in my late teens or early 20s. And then I started looking at what happens in the mind, that what am I engaging when I'm engaging by magical facilities? And through a set of techniques called sensory connections, let me just explain this to you really quick.
Sure.
So healers and magic workers and all these folks will often talk about sending energy. And they'll often talk about sending energy along a connection. So these connections, think of them as like wires or pipes that carry energy. Well, if instead of making a connection and sending energy, we make a connection and just leave it quiet and let it absorb a tiny amount of the energy of whatever it's connected to, in the same way that a thermometer absorbs a tiny amount of heat to measure temperature, we can get a reading on the energy signature of whatever it's connected to. And if we then make a whole network, just a whole bunch of these sensory connections, all throughout a structure, we can get a picture of what's going on there. What parts are active? What parts are inactive? What state is all of this stuff in? And that's what I brought to exploring my own mind. And I would make a connection out, and then I'd make another connection to that first connection and follow it back into my mind and say, what part of my mind is making this connection? And that's how I found ethereal muscles. And I spent much of my 20s looking at those ethereal muscles, looking at how they're powered, looking at where they draw their power from. I call it my core and my power source. More religious listeners might call it their soul. But actually tracing the pathways using these sensory connections and figuring out how to open up more power and open up power to dormant ethereal muscles and awaken them so that I could start using them for whatever they were best at. In the same way that physical muscles, you know, I have an arm muscle that's used for contracting my arm. And I have an arm muscle that's used for extending my arm. And then I have other muscles that are used for moving my legs and balancing while I stand and all these different special purposes. Ethereal muscles have special purposes. Some are used for communicating with spirits and ethereal software. Others are used for working with energy in the body. And so by awakening more of them, it opened up a lot of new facilities that I was able to explore. And so those are some of the foundational techniques of direct magic. Sensory connections, awakening ethereal muscles, and then communicating with spirits and ethereal software.
Right on, man. So for someone who might be wanting to begin flexing these ethereal muscles, what are some of the first things they can look at doing to just to recognize that they're even there?
That's a great question. So I wrestled with this for a long time. When I first started blogging in 2010, I wrote some posts about energy meditations because that's just like the default way that most people learn or teach how to start engaging these things, how to start working with energy. And we ran into a problem. There was a set of readers that already had some facility with energy and ethereal muscles that this worked great for. And then there were other readers whose ethereal muscles were completely dormant. They weren't able to engage them at all. And so I could give them all the visualizations I wanted and it wouldn't do anything because their ethereal muscles weren't listening in the first place.
Hmm.
So a couple of years ago, when I started writing this book, and the book, by the way, it's the draft in progress is available for free on my website. It's free because I want to get these ideas out there. You'll see a banner along the top that says start here. Just click it. You'll get the book. When I started writing that book, what I said was, hey, I have all of this, all of these tools in ethereal software, and I work with all these spirits who make ethereal software. Let me talk to them. Let me have them make me a special purpose ethereal software designed for beginners. Let's put a command in there that is really easy to use that will let a beginner connect to the ethereal software and ask it to help them start awakening their ethereal muscles. And when the novice does this, they look at a sigil that's like a symbol that I have bound the ethereal software to. I'll have a story about that in a minute. They look at the sigil, and the software connects to them. It connects to their mind and it starts reading their intent. And then I give them a command to first just test it out and make sure that it's working. And then to ask it to start awakening their ethereal muscles. And it will start sending energy to those parts of their mind and help them start coming online. And then after they've done that, I give them an energy meditation so they can start using those newly awakened ethereal muscles and exercising them and strengthening them as they work with energy in their body. After that, it's a set of exercises to connect to that ethereal software better and to ask it to make lasting connections to your mind so that it can really read your intent a lot more clearly. By the way, that's an incredibly common phenomenon. Most psychics, they have this ethereal software that's connected to their mind and is always listening. And I've worked with a number of psychics and helped one change from one software to another. She was getting intuitions about who would call on the phone and which path to take with driving to avoid traffic and where to find parking and useful things, but kind of trivial things.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a nurse and wanted to start getting medical intuitions. You know, which of my six patients is going to crash, is going to need emergency care to stay alive on my shift? Which of these dozen studies or dozen lab results is the most useful for figuring out the right care to give this patient? And she wasn't getting that, those intuitions, and she really wanted them. So we actually, I talked with the spirits I work with. I asked them for what ethereal software would you recommend for this? And we switched her over. And it took a few months for that new ethereal software to network fully with her brain. But once it did, she started getting all of these really useful intuitions and knowing which of her patients was going to crash. And having no idea where it came from in a mundane way, she didn't like see that that patient looked extra sickly. She just knew through the ethereal software what was going to happen. It wound up being really useful to her. And then I used similar techniques to activate psychic intuitions for myself. So what I want to communicate with that is when I talk about, hey, this is how it works, a lot of people, I get the feeling when they say this is how it works, they have some intuition. They think that's a great story or it just makes sense to them. And I love that. I love hearing people's explanations for how a thing works. But what I want to communicate is that I then take the next step of trying to use that model to solve a problem and to solve a problem in a way that would never have occurred to me if I didn't have that model, if I didn't have an idea of ethereal software and of different ethereal softwares having different capabilities. It never would have occurred to me to switch my friend from one software to another. And so the model gave me a useful, what scientists would call a prediction, that turned out to be accurate. And that's why I have confidence in what I'm doing and what I'm saying about how this all works.
Yeah, man. I mean, you make it sound good. So ethereal software, obviously that's a new term to a lot of people. That would be the mechanism that the spirits use to help us with our requests in a sense.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah. So it's a new term, but it's actually an old concept. Chaos magic talks about egregores and servitors.
Right.
These are these external forces that mages channel and ask for help. Reiki practitioners talk about channeling energy from the universe. And if you talk to them, they clearly understand that they're not channeling energy from Jupiter or Alpha Centauri. They're channeling energy from something that's all around us, that some force that they don't fully understand. And they've chosen to call that force the universe. If you talk to psychics, they'll say a similar thing about receiving information from a universal field. And what was happening, and what I saw happening, is with all of these grand terms, right? This is an egregore. It is the sum of all of the intents of every human in the world. Or I'm channeling an energy from the universe. If we want to then talk about, well, how does that thing operate? What algorithm does it use? How can we reprogram it to work better? If I ask, how can we reprogram the universe to work better? That's a crazy idea. That's just, I would reflexively flinch away from even asking that. But if we choose to call it ethereal software, and we then ask, how can we reprogram this ethereal software to work better? How can we add a new capability to this ethereal software to do healing energy for this new condition? Well, that just sounds like a software upgrade. That's a really natural question. And I actually picked the name consciously. I used to call them systems, like computer system. And it was really confusing for my readers because there are also these different systems of magic, right? Like chaos magic is a system of magic and Golden Dawn is a system of magic. And so when I talk about channeling systems, it's a word that already has a lot of meanings. And my readers were finding it confusing. And I actually have a series of posts where I said, hey guys, help me come up with a good metaphor. And we wound up at ethereal software. So this meaning, what I just explained to you, was actually very consciously chosen.
Right. Nice. So, right. Servitors, we typically would think of them as conscious temporary entities or something to that degree. But your term implies you think of these mechanisms closer to scripts of code rather than a conscious slave being type of thing.
The way I think about it is consciousness has to run on something, right?
Mm-hmm.
My consciousness runs on my neurons. I can imagine a computer that's conscious, and its consciousness would run on its transistors.
Okay.
And the consciousness and the intent and all of the details of how that servitor behaves, it has to run somewhere. And I want to mention, it's easy as a human to kind of imagine a mind that's free-floating out in the world. And that's because when we humans interact with other humans, it's really important to simulate their minds. So we have a lot of special purpose circuitry in our mind for simulating other minds. And you can see this in a lot of the world's religions. That's why it's so easy to imagine a rock or a tree having consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
When we dig down into what actually happens, what I find is that that consciousness needs something to run on. When I connect to spirits, when I work with spirits, I will sometimes connect to their mind using these sensory connections that I talked about with the healing example earlier, and see what the structures are that are involved. And it's a lot of really dense structures that look a lot like my ethereal muscles. And when I send out my intent, it's tempting to use that human facility to simulate human minds, to just imagine intent as a free-floating unitary object that can kind of go out into the world and reach out its feelers and, you know, reach over with its noodly appendage to cause a change. But if we really think about the complexity of what's happening and really grasp that thought is my nerves firing in my brain or some similar physical phenomenon, we say, wow, what actually has to happen under the hood to send out my thought? Where does that program, where does that intent have to run?
Hmm.
And my answer to that is ethereal software. So what I would say is that a servitor sounds like a program that somebody has created, an ongoing request that is running in some ethereal software that they have access to.
Hmm.
And an egregore is the much larger and more full-bodied and able to accept these requests. So an egregore maps to ethereal software.
Right on. That makes a lot of sense. I think that's a pretty practical way of explaining some things that seemed very mysterious and kind of creepy to some degree. But, you know, entities, they really are of interest to me. And most magical guests I've had have emphasized how important it is to study these particular beings and call on the right ones for the right purposes. But I don't see that as much in your writing. I guess you see that as less important because you can kind of program your own ethereal software as opposed to going to an entity who specializes in a particular area.
You know, that's a really interesting question. This is something that I've been wrestling with in how do I teach this? A lot of my own work actually involves working with spirits or entities.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I haven't shared them as much is I don't assign them to a particular pantheon. I don't say, let's work with Zeus, or let's work with this fire elemental, or let's work with this named spirit.
Mm-hmm.
The way this happened for me is I was doing my own work and I was tracing some connections in my mind, looking at how my mind was powered. And I found some spirits on the other end of those connections and I started talking with them. I started working with them and they would teach me some techniques. And then as I started learning more techniques, I had some other spirits come and connect to me and want to see what I was doing because they thought that that looked really neat and they wanted to learn it too. And so I started working with them and I would show them what I knew and they would show me what they knew. And through just kind of networking with a lot of different spirits, I wound up with a group that I work with almost daily. And whenever I want to learn a new technique, I'll call them up and I'll ask them how to do this thing. And sometimes they know and they just show me and sometimes they don't. And we work together to develop it.
Hmm.
The thing is, it's hard for me to say, hey, it's really important to work with the right spirit because I have this group that I work with. It's similar to how if you worked at a company, you'd say, you know, it's really important to collaborate with a great marketing person and a great business development person and a great salesperson. But you wouldn't say, and so you should channel the spirit of this famous marketing person, right? You'd say, you should, you know, put out an ad on Monster.com. You should hire someone. And where I'm winding up is the ethereal software that I'm distributing with my book that's tied to that sigil. That's made by these spirits that I work with. And so one of the things that we're programming in is a facility to ask that software for advice. And if it has the intelligence in itself, it will present essentially a vision of an avatar, a vision of an angel or a spirit or whatever that you can talk with. And if it doesn't know enough to answer that question, it will connect you to one of the actual spirits that I work with, and they'll be able to help you out. And the intent there is that as people learn more and start asking more advanced and more intricate questions, they slowly transition from essentially reading the help files in the software to actually talking with the spirits and getting that training. So one of the things on my mind is definitely, how do we get people the right kind of guidance from spirits? Because I've benefited from this so tremendously. But I think it's a different approach than most people take, and I'm still working out the details.
Right on. Yeah, spirit contact, it seems to be just one of those things. The floodgates are either wide open or nobody's home. And communicating with entities, it's probably the most abstract and provocative idea for a lot of listeners. And it's something I've been able to do on psychedelics a time or two, but I'd love the validation that it can be done reliably with a sober mind, and, you know, long-forming relationships can happen. But how can we strengthen our ability to make contact? How do we go about it?
So there's actually a whole series of techniques that I've learned and that I'm going to be writing about. The first step is simply learning to quiet one's mind, right? Think of the spirit as kind of whispering into your mind. Mm-hmm. And if you have a lot of thoughts going on, it's going to be hard to hear those whispers.
Okay.
And that's a good first attempt. That's actually where I started. But then after that, we take these sensory connections, which is another set of techniques that I teach, and we use that to feel in our mind, where is the spirit connecting? And spirits will generally connect to the same place over and over. And we learn to engage that part of the mind, that set of ethereal muscles, when we're talking with the spirit. And it's like, I think of it as almost thinking with that part of the mind. I don't know if this is a metaphor that will translate if a person hasn't done it, but it's like engaging a part of the mind and then thinking my idea. And by keeping that part engaged, it's like the thoughts echo in that part. And the mechanism for what's actually happening under the hood is, as a person thinks, as thoughts and words and concepts pass through the brain, there's all of this activity in the brain. And if we put a person in an fMRI and look at how their brain is firing, we find out that there's actually a lot of similarities from one brain to the next. So it's not like you have one pattern and I have some completely different pattern when we think about a concept like spirits or justice or success or whatever. We actually have very similar patterns. And it turns out that we also have very similar energy patterns. The energy signature that our brains enter when we think these concepts seems to be pretty similar. And so when I communicate with a spirit, what I'm doing is taking all the energy signatures that my brain enters as I think that message. I gather them up, I package them up, and I send them in a similar way to how you might send healing energy. And the spirit then unpackages them and puts it in their, whatever the equivalent of their brain is, and hears my thoughts echoed in their mind, as their mind enters the same energy signatures that my mind was in when I thought that message. And then they package up their message in a similar way and send it to me. And I unpackage it and, one concept at a time, place that concept into my brain and let my brain enter that energy signature and feel what that concept is. And as you might imagine, at first, this was really, really slow and really, really hard. But after doing it for a few years, it's kind of like having a conversation. It's roughly as fast as talking. One of the really interesting things is occasionally the spirit will use a concept that I'm not familiar with. And when that happens, it's like my brain stops. My brain like can't get into that state. And I have to say, hold on. Break that down into smaller concepts. Break that down into, you know, bits that I'm familiar with. And then they do. And then I get the concept. And then once I have that concept in my mind, if they then use the large concept again, the one that I wasn't able to handle, if they then use it again a few minutes later, I can hear it and I recognize it as that thing they just explained to me. So when we're talking with spirits, there's actually a whole set of techniques. This set of techniques is also useful for talking with ethereal software. It takes months for ethereal software to connect to a person's brain. And if you only want to use one, if you just want to turn on psychic intuitions, then awesome. Do that. That will be a well-spent few months. But I don't want to use just one software. I want to use a dozen or more. I actually just last week switched from one ethereal software for psychic intuitions to another that seems to be better for some human events around business. And I was able to do that in about a day because I have all these other techniques with how to do the communication. So it's a combination of making it faster, making it more reliable, and also making it more accurate. What I found happened as I was first learning these techniques, as I was first learning to package up my thoughts and then unpackage the spirit's message, I would have a spirit send me a message the old way, the way where it's just kind of dropping the signatures into my brain. And then the new way, where it was sending me this package, and I would read them. And I thought that what was going to happen was the old way was going to be really accurate, and the new way was going to be inaccurate and eventually through practice become as accurate as the old way and just be a little easier for the spirit to work with and let me talk with more spirits who maybe didn't know as much about talking with humans. But what actually happened is I found that the old way, where I was kind of having the thoughts dropped into my brain and then feeling into them, I would get one or two words of each sentence along with an emotional feel of like hopeful or sad or whatever. And then my unconscious mind would fill in the gaps in the same way that if I told you, you know, new job along with a feeling of hope, you could probably, and we're talking about your career, you could probably fill in the gaps of what my sentence was more or less. That's what my unconscious mind was doing. And as I learned to package and unpackage these messages, I started getting more and more words and more accuracy in what I was sending and receiving. And that was actually a really great surprising result. I love getting surprising results because I always have this fear in the back of my mind that what if all of this is just placebo? It's just my expectations manifesting in front of me. And at least once a month, I get some result that I completely did not expect. I actually feel the surprise in my body and in my chest. And I say, wow, okay, I'm getting the opposite of what I expected. You know, yeah, I want more concrete testing eventually. And I'd love to tell you about Healing Lab where I'm doing that. But it's a great, just a personal confirmation that I'm really working with something. So yeah, that's how I do communication is I package up the message and I send it to the spirit and I receive their message and I unpackage it. And that's a series of exercises that I'm going to be digging into in the book as I return to it later this year.
Right on, man. Yeah, that is so interesting. I mean, so many people probably have a hard time thinking these things are even possible. To go a little bit further with this, in the more advanced stages, can you elaborate on how a relationship with a reoccurring entity evolves and develops over months or years even?
Sure. So there's one group of spirits that I've been working with for 4 or 5 years, probably. And at first, I would just contact whatever spirit happened to be available. I'd contact some ethereal software and say, hey, I want to know about sensory connections, or I want to know about shielding, or I want to know about manifesting. Connect me to someone who can talk about that. And I would get whatever random spirit happened to be around. And it was great. They all really knew what they were talking about. And it would be like if, you know, you went to office hours for a professor and you got whatever TA happened to be available, right? And they're going to answer your question. And it's going to be super helpful. But over time, I started working more and more with this one spirit who specializes in communication. And in part, that was because most spirits have, at least most spirits I work with, are kind of androgynous. But this one has a really feminine energy. And at the time I was getting involved in erotic energy, and I started doing that with her, and it felt really good. And so I would regularly connect to her to explore that.
Hey now.
And if you think about how human relationships form, a lot of times that's what they form around, right?
Yeah, it's true.
And so I started calling her a lot for that. And then I would ask her advice about things. I'd say, hey, I'm trying to figure out this thing with manifesting. What do you think? Right? Instead of calling and asking for whatever manifesting expert happened to be available, I'd ask her. And sometimes she'd have an answer. And sometimes she'd say, oh, I know a spirit who is an expert at that. Let me connect you guys. And then sometimes I'd be talking with that spirit, and maybe he wasn't as experienced working with humans, and so he wasn't as good at communicating with me. Or maybe I was just getting exhausted because I was doing a, you know, half hour to an hour session instead of a 15 minute session. And I would say, hey, can you, to the spirit that I knew, that I now call Laura, can you handle this communication for me? Can you have him communicate with you? And then you make it really easy for me to read the message by doing more of the work of dropping it into my mind. And this became part of a pattern where I would just call her up and say, hey, this is what I want to learn about. Would you be up for helping me figure out how to go about it and helping manage the communication with the other spirits? If we have a team of like five guys who are all collaborating on a project, that's really more than I can handle for communication, but it's no big deal for her because that's what she specializes in. And she, I've asked her, hey, what do you get out of this? What do you benefit from? And some of the things she tells me are, I ask really interesting questions. And if you go to any scientist, they'll tell you that at least half of doing useful work is having an interesting question. And because I draw from medicine and from computer science, my background is computer science. And so whenever we're talking about messaging, I'll say, hey, why are we preparing a message and then sending it? Why aren't we streaming messages? And that actually led to some really cool research that sped up their communication. I will ask good questions and very occasionally have good answers. But I think that a lot of what I contribute is asking interesting questions. And she enjoys being part of that conversation. And so she's always happy to help me facilitate these training sessions. And it winds up being this really comfortable relationship. And she'll tell me about what she's working on. And I'll sometimes have some ideas about how to, what questions to ask as she's learning healing work, how to organize this group that she's working with and how to get them excited and invigorated about the project, how to speak from her goals rather than just the technical question that she's asking. So I try to bring whatever my skills are to that relationship in the same way that if you had, you know, a technical expert that you worked with a lot, you know, if you collaborated with somebody who did all your marketing, you know, you would help them out with whatever you knew, and they'd help you out with whatever they knew. There's no concept of money there, but if you think about a community that everyone helps each other, that's really what's going on.
Hmm. Right on, man. You make it seem so normal. And, you know, and much of the conversation or the communication with entities seems to be about people in the physical world, human beings asking for things or asking for understanding. But through this communication, have you gotten any indications of what life is like for them or what their reality is like? Because you mentioned coming from a scientific atheistic background. I had an atheistic period as well. And there are spiritual implications for thinking about conscious beings that aren't in bodies. It's weird. Have you gotten any clues to what their reality is like?
Absolutely. So that was actually one of the first questions that I asked as I started to get to know these spirits as people rather than just as, you know, online oracle that I can ask questions of. And they really enjoy exploring how all this stuff works, at least the spirits that I work with. They have at least as much passion as I do for asking, wow, when I do this thing, what's really happening? What's going on under the hood? And what it seems like is a lot of status among spirits in this group is about who's coming up with really interesting new ideas that are working for everyone and getting everyone better results. They also enjoy connecting with each other. And when I was doing erotic energy with Laura, she would also do that with other spirits. And they seem to enjoy doing that with each other, which I think is awesome and kind of humanizing.
Hmm.
In terms of how do I conceptualize this as from an atheistic scientific perspective, what I say is just as I could imagine a mind running on transistors, an artificial intelligence, I can imagine a mind running on energetic connections where the thoughts are bits of energy that pass along these connections and activate or deactivate connections. I can imagine essentially building a brain out of energy pathways and energies. And that's how I conceptualize these spirits.
That's interesting, man. And I guess one thought I had when preparing for the show is if you wanted to keep this within a materialist scientific paradigm, could you say that these beings that you're in contact with are just people on other planets doing exactly what you're doing?
So the way I think of this, first, I want to address the word materialist because people often hear, when I say materialist, what they hear is concrete physical stuff, right? Only stuff that you can reach out and touch. Mm-hmm. And that's not at all what materialist means. Materialists believe in dark matter, which only interacts with gravity and doesn't, you can't reach out and touch it. Materialists believe in photons, which interact with matter in certain limited ways, but pass right through glass and do all sort of not ordinary matter things. What materialism means is that anything that I have can be broken down into smaller parts. So if we have a car, we can break it down into the engine and the pistons and down into molecules and atoms and protons and electrons and quarks. If we have a mind, that there's no such thing as just a free-floating, inherently mental object, that a mind sits on top of or is implemented in nerves, which we can then drill down into molecules and atoms and so on, that a mind is implemented in transistors, which we can drill down into silicon and so on. And so what materialism means is we can understand how the world works. And I want to mention, science wasn't always materialist.
Mm-hmm.
When science first started out in the age of Galileo and Newton, everyone was very religious. And they went looking for a soul. And they went looking for angels. And they tried to find all of these inherently mental things. And they failed. And they tried again. And they failed. And one of the wonderful things about science is it learns from failures. And eventually, scientists came to say, wow, when I look for things that are inherently mental, that don't break down into smaller pieces, I never find anything. And everything that I actually do find, I can break down into smaller pieces. And that's where we got this idea that probably everything in the world, we can break down into smaller pieces. And what I'll say, as someone who works with ethereal stuff, connections and energy and ethereal software and spirits, everything that I've found, I could break down into smaller pieces. And by doing that, I could develop useful techniques for doing things that I never would have thought to do or never been able to do if I hadn't tried to break them down into smaller pieces. So that's what materialism means. And that's why I would say I am a materialist.
Right on. I mean, it makes sense. So you mentioned the hive scenario, and let's get into healing a little deeper. You have pages of case studies on your site. You seem to be very methodical about documenting these cases and instances of healing. And personally, healing feels like the most hokey to me of most of the things that people talk about with magic. But it also seems to be the most cut and dry, what should be provable effect from magic. Can you talk to us about your successes in healing and this healing lab that you mentioned?
Absolutely. So Healing Lab, its mission is to develop a scientific understanding of energy healing. And the reason is that science advances, scientific revolutions happen by exploring phenomena that can't be explained in today's science. And we could find histories in the past. We could find examples in history. 400 years ago, weavers in Venice got the first lenses. They used them to look at their threads so they could make better cloth. And then they turned around and looked at water and discovered bacteria. And they called them animalcules. And this led to the germ theory of disease and modern medicine. And I'm sure that at the time, that seemed incredibly hokey. There's actually examples from the 1800s of a doctor who said, hey, I've noticed that when doctors work on cadavers and then turn around and do surgeries, people die. We should wash our hands.
Right.
And he was drummed out of medicine. He became a pariah for having the audacity to suggest that doctors' hands might be unclean and that we should wash them, because the germ theory of medicine was not yet cemented as a reality. It just seemed bizarre. Everybody knew that disease was caused by bad humors and malicious spirits. How dare you suggest that these are on the hands of doctors? Another example, quantum physics. It started by looking at photons and discovering all these really weird behaviors that we now recognize as wave-particle duality and the observer effect. Quantum physics came from finding aberrations. And most people don't know this, but transistors are based on the quantum behavior of silicon atoms. If we don't have if we don't have quantum physics, we don't have transistors, and we don't have the modern world. Everything that we have today is built on finding aberrations, finding phenomena that can't be explained in the science of the time, and hunting it down and figuring it out until we understand it. And when we understand energy healing and magic, it's going to impact everything from medicine to biology to physics and a lot more. And I have no idea where that leads. Just like those 17th century weavers had no concept of antibiotics, but I have a faith that it leads somewhere amazing. There are a few reasons why I'm focused on healing. The first is it provides really concrete results, and I really love helping people. The second is there's actually a lot of great research going on in energy healing right now. The term to Google is biofield healing, B-I-O-F-I-E-L-D. That's the term that the National Institute of Health uses to refer to energy healing. There are placebo-controlled studies in peer-reviewed journals that show statistically significant results. There are cell culture studies in peer-reviewed journals that show that when you apply whatever this healing energy is to cell cultures like MRSA, it does something to them. And it does things that can be detected with traditional chemistry. There are studies that show that when you apply healing energy to plants and animals, that it affects them too. And notice that plants and animals and cell cultures don't get affected by placebo. So all of these studies really strongly suggest that there's something going on here. And because there's a culture of doing scientific studies and doing peer-reviewed publications around healing, and because it is in the culture more respectable to say I'm doing research around healing than to say I'm doing research around magic, I think that this is a great way to get started with making this part of a publicly acceptable, scientifically studied domain. And then we all get to see what amazing things come out the other end of that research.
Man, it would be a beautiful world indeed. And I've had other guests cite these same studies that are going on, but why can't it break into the mainstream? You know, what's keeping this still at bay? Is it just not repeatable enough?
So I have two answers for you. And I want to say that I spent about 6 months this year writing and rewriting and thinking about exactly that question, because that's what Healing Lab wants to solve. And in order to solve it, we need to understand it. What's going on is really two things. The first is that these studies are primarily single blind. So blind means that the person doesn't know whether they're getting the real treatment or the placebo. And single blind means that the subject doesn't know, but the practitioner knows. So if you've read studies where the practitioner does acupuncture, and sometimes they put the needle in the wrong spot intentionally, and they do fake acupuncture. Obviously, the practitioner has to know if they're doing real acupuncture or fake acupuncture. Well, what if they're really confident when they meet the person, when they're doing the real acupuncture, and they're less confident when they meet the person and they're doing the fake acupuncture? They're not intentionally doing this. It's just an unconscious thing. What if what we're detecting is really that people have a strong placebo response to confident acupuncturists and a weak placebo response to not confident acupuncturists? I don't think that's what's going on, but the reason why all modern medical studies, the gold standard is double blind, is because of exactly that problem, because that problem does come up in medical research. So double blind means that not only does the subject not know if they're getting real or placebo, but the practitioner doesn't know either. And that's a problem for anything hands-on. Mm-hmm. So what I've developed is a set of healing techniques where I meet with the person. I don't know whether I'm going to do a real healing or not. I meet with them. I answer all their questions. I touch their head or wherever I'm doing the healing technique, and I establish a connection. Then I go into the other room. And at that point, I find out if they're real or placebo. And I either do the energy work, or I sit there and read the paper and don't do anything. I never talk with that person again. An assistant who hasn't talked with me goes, thanks them, and shows them out. And we then collect data online. And then after collecting the data a month later, we let them know whether they were real or placebo. And if they're placebo, we invite them back for their free healing session. So the first reason why this isn't taken more seriously is because we haven't met the gold standard for medical research. We haven't done a lot of double-blind studies, and that's one of the things I'm looking to change. But there's a bigger reason, and that's because pills, pharmaceuticals, surgeries, all of the widely accepted treatments, we can explain how they work in terms of medicine, and then we can drill down into how they work in terms of biology and chemistry and physics. And they're all built on accepted physics. And we've been studying physics for over 2,000 years, and we're pretty good at it by now. And to suggest that there's a part of physics that we haven't found, I mean, there certainly is. And we certainly are finding new aspects of physics all the time. But we need extraordinary evidence before we believe that any one model is really part of the physical universe. And to tell you how strong that is, in medicine, we look for 95 to 99% certainty that a treatment is effective. And if it's 1% to 5% chance that it was just a coincidence, maybe everybody in the treatment group would have gotten better anyway, and everybody in the placebo group would have stayed sick anyway. Maybe it just, you know, you could flip a coin 20 times and get 10 heads and then 10 tails. It happens. Mm-hmm. And if we have a 1% to 5% chance that that's what happened, that's okay. We will use that treatment. In physics, we aim for 5 sigmas of certainty. That means a 1 in 3.5 million chance of error. That's 200,000 times as accurate. We're not going to get that by running placebo-controlled studies. We can't do a placebo-controlled study that's 200,000 times as large. So the answer there, my answer, is, hey, in addition to double-blind placebo-controlled studies for healing techniques, let's also develop some techniques that are maybe useless for healing, but are great for demonstrating to a high level of accuracy. And this is where my computer science background comes in. So computer science does a lot with messaging algorithms. How can I send a message from one place to another? And so I said, well, hey, energy workers talk about feeling energy all the time, and they talk about sending energy all the time. So let's get two people, two different rooms. They're not talking in any way. The sender flips a coin. If it's heads, they send energy. If it's tails, they don't do anything. They just read the paper for a minute. The receiver says when they feel energy, and we look at the correlation. So we have a random stream of data that's coming in, and we're seeing if that same stream is reproduced by the receiver. And I said, well, hey, if we want 1 in 3.5 million chance of error, how many trials is this going to take? Is this going to take 3.5 million trials? No. If it was 100% accurate, now nothing's 100%, but let's just make the math easy. If it's 100% accurate, we get 1 in 3.5 million chance of error in 22 trials. You can do that in an afternoon. If it's 90% accurate, maybe we need 200 or so trials. I'd have to run some statistics once I find out the exact level of accuracy we're getting. But this is a solvable problem. And the next question then is, how do we get that accuracy up? All human senses are susceptible to our expectations. There are great experiments with using vision and sound, these senses that we really, really rely on, and showing how if somebody's primed to expect something, it will affect their sight or their hearing. And everybody knows about how wine tasters, if you take great wine and you put it in a cheap bottle, wine tasters will think it's cheap. And if you take cheap wine and put it in a great bottle, wine tasters will think it's great. Now, that doesn't mean that wine is imaginary or taste doesn't exist. It's just a matter of how the human mind works, that it's always influenced by expectations. So one of my active areas of research is how can we more accurately send and sense energy when we genuinely don't know what to expect? How can we remove the expectations and still get really accurate results so that we can do that physics level of proof? And I think that the combination of the two of those, demonstrating to physicists that there's something worth studying here, so that the physics community starts to try to unravel ethereal structures and the biofield and all of the rest of this, and also demonstrating really useful techniques to the medical community so that more and more people start wanting energy healing and start seeking it out and start asking for it, I think that the combination of those two things can really help this go mainstream, and that everything else is going to follow along after we get healing accepted.
Well said. And kind of like we talked about earlier with the theatrics, it seems to be about heightening the possibility of the expectations that these things would work. And in your experience, since you've done this quite a bit, what have you found to be the limitations of healing? Or can you not say until we really raise the wider expectations? Maybe it doesn't have limits.
So when we talk about limits, I want to distinguish between limits given roughly today's level of technology and fundamental ultimate limits.
Fair.
100 years ago, the best engineers of the time, the smartest people, said that escaping Earth's gravity well and getting into space was impossible. Not just really difficult, but there's no way we will ever do that. And 50 years later, they were observably and obviously wrong. So I want to avoid saying actual absolute limits, but given the current technology, given what I'm working with, it seems to me, the way I think about energy healing is that it either accelerates or slows cellular processes. And when I design new healing techniques, when I say, hey, what type of energy do I want to apply to what tissue in the body? I think about it in that way. I think about upregulating or downregulating cellular processes. And that gives us a good guideline for what things will be amenable to energy healing and what things won't be. So if we have a chronic condition like hives, where there are some processes making it better and some processes making it worse, if we can accelerate the ones making it better and slow the ones making it worse and let that run for 1 hour or 8 hours or a couple of weeks, we're going to see good results. If we have somebody who has a cut, a laceration, or a heart attack, or a burst appendix, these are not the kind of things that need subtle nudges to cellular processes. These are the kind of things that need surgery. So I would expect that energy healing will probably never do or never solve the kind of problems that we solve with surgery. And I'm expecting that energy healing can have some great results for the kind of things that we address with pharmaceuticals. That said, I should make a disclaimer. One, none of this is accepted science. This is my current hypothesis that will probably change over the next decade. And two, I'm not a physician, and I'm definitely not saying to replace your meds with energy healing today. I'm saying, where will we someday, after research with the scientific and medical community, eventually get?
Right, right. Man, wow. Well, this has been fascinating, man. Before we go, please remind the listeners where they can follow up on your website and with your free ebook in progress.
Awesome. So if you like what I've been talking about, go to magicofthought.com. That's magicofthought.com. So magic with the CK. That's where I blog. I have every week a new blog post. And if you look at the banner at the top, it says, you know, are you new here? Start here. And that link takes you to the book in progress. It's free because I want to get as many people exploring this stuff as possible. I want to get the ideas out there. If you're interested in the energy healing research that I'm doing, go to healinglab.org. That's healinglab.org. That's where I'm doing the healing research. That's where I'm going to be publishing the studies. And starting very soon, we're going to have case studies in a healing for better sleep. I'm still deciding if I'm going to do only in person or if I'm going to also allow virtual. But definitely, if you live in the San Francisco Bay Area, check that out. The deal is you get free healings. I get free data. Everybody wins.
Right on, Mike. Well, very much appreciate the time. A fresh approach to these ideas, no doubt. Take care out there and best of luck.
Thanks so much for having me.
You got it. All right. How was that one, Higher Side Chatters? I actually expect this to be an episode that a lot of people like. I really enjoy the magic topic, and Mike's approach is pretty different and, pardon the pun, very direct. He wants to get in there, not be shy about it, and see how these things actually work. I respect that a lot. And he didn't say this, but I find Mike to be in such a unique camp, almost as if he was wired to be scientifically minded, but at the same time has some seemingly strong natural ability in magic. So he's walking between these two worlds that normally mix like oil and water. And over the course of the show, I think you get a good sense of how science should be approaching magic and its testability. Another thing I would say is that it's normally a bit of a pet peeve of mine that so many magic researchers end up using their own glossary of terms. If you start looking into a lot of the authors and adventurers in this realm, it's something you'll realize pretty quick. And it always makes me think that their ego is so out of control that they need their own brand of magic. But I do think Mike's case is different. I don't think he's doing this out of ego, but sort of modernizing some of the language and putting it in terms that science will probably have an easier time adopting. Even I think some of his terms helped me to conceptualize these things a bit better than I did just a week ago. For some people, though, probably a lot of those science-minded folks, how a particular thing is framed is really important. So for some to not feel goofy getting into this stuff, I think terms like ethereal muscles and ethereal software are going to be more useful to some people than terms like spellcasting and servitors. It's an interesting thing that if you tweak terms enough, you can talk about the very same thing and sort of circumvent the decades of stigma that's been attached to it. Humans are weird. But I've been trying to practice more energy meditations, and I got a pretty serious ancestor altar going here. I went down to the local Botanica, picked up some specific regional oils and incense, got some Caridad del Cobre on Gordon White's recommendation, had the nice lady mix me up some road opener, and I've been giving it a shot. I know there will be comment after comment about how people shouldn't get into these things. Magic is the devil's toolbox. And I'll get called a disinfo plant because I encourage psychedelics and magic. But these people that think they know the best and only way to live, they can fuck right off. Puritanical moral judgments are just not for me. And I'm not really encouraging anyone to do anything. I'm just telling you that I'm doing it. I find it interesting. And at least in terms of psychedelics, I've had some profound and life-changing results. Other people have turned themselves into vegetables, so there's a spectrum. But I want to experience things. I want to try things responsibly. And if I don't hurt anyone else, then who really cares? Of course, I don't need to murder someone to see if I feel guilty or wrong. But how are you going to say that thoughtful meditation and flipping tarot cards is bad? To me, it's as morally neutral as exercise, as going to the gym. It very much might be a tool of the elite, but it could also be our tool. But see, this is Satan's mouthpiece you're hearing this from, so of course I'm going to say that. Maybe I've been spending a little too much time at the crossroads, people, but I hope you listeners are still as interested as I am to test the waters of consciousness, see if we can't affect our reality for the better. What have you got to lose? I mean, you binge watch Stranger Things and play 4 hours of Overwatch. but focusing your conscious attention on some sigils is a waste of time. Not that I don't love both Stranger Things and Overwatch, but let's call a spade, it's self-imposed adult babysitting when you get down to it. Speaking of sigils, though, Mike does make the public promise in the second hour that he will have up a double-blind sigil study on his website, and he would love the listeners to partake in it so he can gather the collective data, and I think it would be fun. So definitely check out his website, magicofthought.com. That's magic with a C and a K, magicofthought.com. Also in the Plus show, we get a little bit into Mike's successes with sex magic and willing his partner to orgasm like the goddamn Merovingian again. And let's take off the puritanical kid gloves for a second and accept the fact that we all enjoy a nice orgasm from time to time. And giving them out to willing partners ain't too shabby either. It's not bad. It's not inappropriate. It's just a thing. But we do talk about beginner steps for walking down that path. We talk about choosing the right language and thoughts for magic in general, how manifesting and visualizations work. And I know we've had guests who've speculated that Hollywood's role in the big conspiracy is to influence and crowdsource manifestation, this idea that Hollywood is violent to induce thoughts of a violent world. I think that's a concept a lot of people have entertained, but it wouldn't be possible if thoughts didn't influence reality. So maybe we can explore the mechanism and how we can use it in our own lives for good reasons. Big fan of this show, though. Useful information you can adopt into your own life. Maybe we learned a little bit about the mind-material world interaction. You know, I get a lot of mail from people liking the show because they like my style of hosting. I do appreciate that. I also get a lot of emails wishing I challenged guests more. And it's true, I could do that, but doing it wrong with the wrong guests can cause people to clam up, which is an issue. But I agree in some cases I could challenge guests a bit more. But what I think I do well as a host is I try to combat vagueness. And I've never really put it in those terms before, but when a guest has a broad, wild claim, I might not challenge it per se, but I definitely think I try to get them to elaborate and get into more detail or explain how something they're suggesting would work. But I do think the 2-hour uninterrupted time frame helps me combat the type of vagueness that a person can get away with on Coast to Coast with a commercial break every 8 minutes. I think if you look at my worst episodes, it's the guests who really can't elaborate beyond their talking points. They're used to using these broad generalizations, and when I ask, okay, well, how does that work with X or Y? They just do a lot of waffling and hemming and hawing, and I think that's the greatest unifying factor on the THC episodes that are the weakest. And I only bring that up because it's a big part of what I like about Mike's approach. He doesn't seem to like vagueness either. And when I found his site, I was like, okay, here's a guy who wants to get it all out in the open, and I like that. Fun stuff for sure, but I'm going to have to get on with it. You guys got stuff to do anyway, or if you didn't before, you do now. So that's it for me. Your move, modern mages of the new magical era. You're fucking... Hey guys, thanks for listening to the first hour of the Higher Side Chats podcast with me, Greg Carlwood. If you don't know, there is a second hour to all the episodes we do around here. Generally, we're able to get a lot deeper into the topics and ideas that a guest is about, so if you enjoyed what you've heard from THC for free, consider signing up at thehiresidechatsplus.com to get the second hour of the five shows I put together each month. I never really wanted to be a paid subscriber podcast, but I really hate the idea of spending airtime promoting some product that's completely unrelated and telling you the best way to support the show is to buy an audiobook or new underwear by mail or something crazy like that. So instead, if you like the show, double your time with it for $5 a month and let's cut out all the other shit. It's half the price of a movie ticket and you get at least an extra 5 hours of show a month. Collectively, it keeps us stable and it frees me from wasting your time with anything but the show you came to listen to. It's really the only way for an independent, one-man show to make it, and I do what I can so that it's worth your while. Since we started this, I've always tried to use the subscriptions to improve the podcast and make signups more advantageous. It started with just a second hour for the main show, but now we've got a nice forum going where people can get deeper in conversation about the episodes with other listeners, submit a candidate in the guest request thread, or share their own personal projects to get out of the soul-crushing 9-to-5 cog-in-the-wheel life on the entrepreneurs thread. The forum and the plus comments are always the first places I try to go for listener engagement, but it does get harder as the show gets more popular. Because of that, there's also a direct messaging feature that you can use to reach me through the plus site also. But beyond the forum, if you like any of the music I've used for THC, most of it I've hired artists to make, and I provided all as free downloads to Plus members too. So if you like a particular song you've heard close the show out recently, come get the MP3. I should also mention that if you don't like the idea of paying $5 recurring every month, I get that. You can buy 3 months, 6 months, or a year up front and just be done with it. I have plenty of listeners who send checks and money orders to the P.O. Box too. I try to make it as easy for people as I can, and you can read more about it on the sign-up page. Also, be sure to check out the FAQ help page on the Plus site if you have any questions or concerns about how to listen to a password-protected show on your devices. I've highlighted a lot of great solutions, and one of those would be the iPhone app that just recently hit the Apple App Store. A super kind and talented listener made it for us, and you can use it to stream or download either the free or the Plus show. If you're on Android, I'd use Pocket Casts or Podcast Addict and subscribe to the feed manually that way. I also try to throw in occasional bonus shows or Q&A shows, and I've got a few other weird ideas I might get to try out soon, but I give you all I can for $5, and I hope you'll at least give it a shot if you've listened to a few free shows and you find them unique or valuable. I know there's a lot of podcasts out there, and I'm just one of them. But if you have any questions, concerns, or comments about any of this, please get in touch with us at thehiresidechatsteam@gmail.com. I also wanted to plug the Higher Side newsletter I'm going to be putting out, totally free for anyone who wants to sign up at the main internet website for the show, thehiresidechats.com. You can also get on that email list through the Higher Side Chats Facebook page. There's a button there as well. But the reason I'm doing this is because I get tons and tons of emails after a show goes up asking me about how I feel about a particular guest or topic, and the wrap-up isn't always the best place to do that, especially if I have anything negative to say. Sometimes the dust needs to settle, sometimes I need to hear feedback from you guys first. There are a lot of factors, but I usually have something to communicate to you, and I just don't get to do it. So on the first of the month, I plan to send out a little newsletter with my thoughts about the five shows the previous month, and talk to you about anything else that's on my mind or that's going on. And what's probably most enticing is that I'm going to give you some insight into at least one guest I have coming up in the month, which people have been begging for some posted schedule for a long time. I personally think I'd like the surprise. But sign up for the Higher Side newsletter. It's free. It comes out on the first of the month, and I won't waste your time with any other emails. And that's it. I appreciate you listening. I try to give alternative ideas and guests a fair shake on a high-quality podcast, expose some deep-level conspiracies without the yelling, and I hope to offer some inspiration that even though the system relentlessly suggests you should follow their blueprint to mediocrity, you can do your own thing and live a much happier life despite all the negativity in the world. So go ahead and treat yourself. Isn't it about time?